The Treehouse, episode 53. Countless screaming Argonauts with Danny Baker and me, Louise Pepper.
Hooray, look at this. It's out of a trap and like a rare gas.
And half my hair's disappeared.
Tremendous. Welcome back, everyone. Not that you've been anywhere, but we have. If you heard the last show, and then you'll know we said we're going to retool, gather everything under one roof, and we are to that end 6 weeks later, back with the spinning bow tie, the baggy pants, and the clouds roll away down Sunnyside Lane. I can't tell you how pleased. We actually are really pleased to be back. Again this morning.
We have to remember how to do it all.
And we're having a good time, aren't we?
You've moved camera angles. I am still in the wardrobe.
Brand new studio here. The idea that we're having a good time, I said, well, maybe we should have recorded this, because when we put out the show, who knows how it'll go. But we do know how it'll go. The Treehouse is here, a good deed in a wicked world, show 53. This is as free as the air for now. We'll see how we go. I'll give you more information on that. But we just thought we'd pop up in your timelines. And as I say, hopefully the hat is on the side of our head. We have no other way of dressing. But we can't keep congratulating everyone for getting back together. We're not Deep Purple, are we?
No.
No.
Original members or not.
And then this probably be a shorter show. That's the plan. Okay. Already longer than a lot of podcasts.
Shorter than... well, say what?
By the word, let's put it that way. I looked and I really thought, well, we'll get straight into it today. We're going to do any other business left over from last time. Some of your emails are still here, of course. But we just wanted to come around and say, you know, we're back. Like there's some slasher leaping out of a cupboard with a huge knife in their hand. But I looked and I couldn't help it. At first I thought it was your husband's birthday, but it's not. It's Simon Bolivar.
Oh,
now Simon Bolivar. But we get to the actual raison for this in a second. But Simon Bolivar, you know Simon Bolivar, yes, 1783, born 1783.
Bolivia?
Yes, he did. He got to Bolivia.
Okay.
There you go. One of the few people. I suppose America and actually most countries are named after people, except Liechtenstein is the only country that's named after the family who bought it. The Liechtenstein family, they bought a country and said, we shall call it Liechtenstein. Anyway, so you've got your Liechtenstein, and but your Bolivia, and I was reading about Bolivia. I thought, well, is it anything in Bolivia? And I'll be come up, Peps, you're the... you're a snappy and let's say smart one of the duo here. Do you know, I mean, you know where vaguely it is, but would you be able to put a pin in a map and say, there's Bolivia?
South America?
Yes, 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 that's a given. I couldn't.
Along the top row?
No, it's not in the top row. It's not on the top shelf. I looked there first. I looked up that way. And yes, you know, you're Brazil and that. And all I want to say is this is our shame. I couldn't. And of course I know all about Bolivia. I know all about Bolivia because it's in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But I'm shaky on Peru even, and Venezuela, Paraguay.
Now, my cousin lived in Peru.
You had a cousin in Peru?
My cousin, Father Ted, the priest.
Oh, no.
Got held up by a gun in Peru. Told you the stories of Cousin Ted?
53 shows in, you're now saying Father Ted was held up in Peru, mugged in Peru.
Yes.
Go on.
Had to, literally, like the old joke, had to show them his cross to dissuade them from bad behavior. He's still with us over in Ireland. He only told us a story two or three years ago. Oh, you know, I was held up by a gun in Peru. No, we didn't know you were held up by a gun in Peru.
Did he tell you where Peru actually is? Could he draw it on the map? Because it's for shame. I could not find it. I know less about South America than any other continent, I think. I know what the Falklands are. So I started thinking, come on, today's the day where we start saying, hats off to Peru, Peru, Bolivia.
Okay.
Simon Bolivar's birthday, who founded. See, that's shaky anyway. In this era when the old statues are coming down, and rightly so.
What were they before he popped along?
Well, exactly. There were people living there, you know. Simon Bolivar comes along, says, I shall call you Bolivia. Right, okay, but they were called Upper Peru for a bit, but it's all the Incas.
Oh, well, that's a bit undignified.
A million last, the Incas. But you don't even know the capital of Bolivia. We'll start the show any second, but we just need capital of Bolivia.
Is it Bolivar?
It's not Bolivar. It's not even La Paz, which you would think.
Oh, I've heard of La Paz.
Sucre.
Sucre is the capital, isn't it? Of it.
Do you know what money they use? For £1 million, what money do they use in Bolivia? And it's a terrific...
Pesos.
No, they don't use pesos. They use the Boliviano.
Oh, that's splendid.
The Boliviano, 100 cents in the Boliviano, and it's worth 11 pence. 11 pence is your Boliviano, yet their national anthem, Bolivia, a most favourable destination.
I think we should go there.
This is why this show's run long, because you look up Simon Bolivar and immediately you're talking about Bolivianos. And a most favourable destiny, actually, is what it is. I looked up their... I promise we're going to move straight on. So I looked up 50 great facts about Bolivia. And of course, there really is a site possibly funded by the Bolivians themselves. 50 great things about Bolivia. This is a good thing. They changed their name in 2009. How about that? Bolivia changed its name in 2009. Puff Daddy changes his every week, gets front pages. Bolivia, an entire nation, nobody knows about it. They went from being the Republic of Bolivia to the plurination state of Bolivia.
Oh, I've never heard of such a thing.
Nation. Anyway, but by the time it got to fact 8 or 9, great facts about Bolivia, it was so thin. With all apologies to...
Well, who decided 50?
Exactly. Yeah. With great apologies to our huge footprint and fan base over there in Bolivia, that's how thin it is, and I promise you. At 8, it had Bolivia has one of the largest butterfly sanctuaries in the world. Not bad, right? Not bad. That's all right. That's number 8. Number 9 beneath it was, there are many excellent facilities at the butterfly sanctuary.
Ah, now.
It's the shops are number 9. The shopping mall at the butterfly sanctuary. These are the great facts about it. But you've got your Lake Titicaca. You got that too.
That's in Bolivia, is it?
That's in Bolivia. Oh,
okay. I thought
Bolivia.
That was Mexican.
You can visit the San Pedro prison. It's a working prison. That's on the great destinations. But the big seller is Salar de Uyuni, which is a 64 million tons of salt on a salt plain. That's their number one. But 64 million tons of salt, the world's biggest salt plain, don't seem a lot. 64 million tons, my old man used to put down a boiled egg every morning. There's plenty there about Bolivia. By all means, go and look where it is on the map. To be honest, I couldn't put a pin in Bulgaria either, but this are the kind of people we're dealing with. Normally, I'd say, what we're doing this morning, Peps? But we just wanted to pop back before putting pressure on you to give us new subjects or contribute to them. But we do have plenty left over from before, and we're now going to sail on. Look at that inch and a half of email you've got, Peps. Give us something from over there.
This is from Roy in Liverpool. Things you've slept through. I've always been a light sleeper, right back to when I was a baby and my dad had to put me on the back seat of his Mini 1000 and drive me round for 20 minutes every night to stop me bawling. With that in mind, this story seems unbelievable. I was around 9 or 10 and we lived in a modest semi next to Ron and Jean, who lived adjoining. The thing I slept through happened suddenly in the middle of one night. My parents say they were woken by a shockingly loud bang. So loud, it woke up Ron and Jean, and Ron rushed round to knock on the front door and ask whether we were okay. My dad was immediately confused, but then a strange smell gave him a clue, and this smell was emanating from my bedroom. He headed straight for the airing cupboard right next to the head of my bed, opened the door and was met by a scene of carnage. His lovingly prepared homebrew, stored on the floor next to the hot water tanks for fermenting potential, had exploded, covering the whole of the interior and its contents with part fermented booze and hundreds of shards of glass, with my head just inches away. My dad closed the door, mystery solved, deciding he'd clean it up in the morning.
Well, this, of course, is the plot to the Bless This House film. I don't know if you know that. Peter Butterworth, living next door to Sid James, he's always been, I think, Dinah Sheridan, isn't it? Saying that's going to blow up in there. I love those squeaky voice. And then sure enough, it did. And this is a real life version. Did anything happen?
I was none the wiser when I awoke the next day. Only a strange smell alerted me to something. What's that funny smell in my room? I apparently asked as I came down for breakfast after a marvellous night's sleep. I've no idea how I slept all this, as I've always had the reputation of waking at the slightest noise.
Wow. Well, there you are. If we can bring you the actual sing from it. And when we go to this Patreon thing, and I'll explain more about that later, I hope to be able to put links up for those who say, tell me more about this Bless This House film, which is usually on television every 15 minutes, but you can see exactly what Peps was talking about. I saw that in the pictures, by the way. I saw
Slim Pickens at the cinema that week.
One of the things I was going to say at the top, there's the Sergeant Pepper film open today. You know, the one with the Bee Gees in, and there was a, you're looking blank and quite rightly, there was a film made, nothing to do with the Beatles, called Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Really?
And George Burns is in it, Steve Martin, Peter Frampton. It was an all musical version.
Is this a cheese dream?
Oh, no, 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 no. The album is a connoisseur's dream. That album is so rotten. It's rotten to the core. And I saw that at the pictures. I think there were three other people in there. And I would like, I'm not trying not to put out new subjects. We're only going to pop back and say hello. But films possibly only you saw at the pictures. I saw Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And there wasn't a lot in for the Bless This House film, either, to be absolutely honest with you. Anyway, that's all we're going to do for now, except we're going to carry on for about another 20 minutes. I'll bring you something from over this side. Remember Justin, who was our Quaker?
Yes!
Our Quaker friend, one of the earliest.
He told us the brilliant Amish joke.
The Amish joke. Clip-clop, silence, clip-clop, silence. A drive-by shunning. That is probably the greatest joke I've ever heard. And he does this, his racket. He's at Cambridge. He's the professor of profundities or something. I do apologize, Justin. But he got in touch because, again, I know there's been a six-week gap. That's nothing. It's just like the flies by.
The school holidays.
School holidays. He's been in touch because you mentioned a cheese dream there. And we did mention those books you used to get that told you what dreams meant. I haven't seen them for ages. You know, it says, if you dream of an owl, it means, you know, you should change your shoes or something. They used to be very, very desperate. But he's a connoisseur of them. He says, Justin, the Quaker from Cambridge here, he is a Quaker. You remember my Amish joke? Yes, we've just done it, thanks. He is a sap, by the way.
Oh, yes.
When we go to the Patreon thing, for one level of it, for those of you good enough to, because we've got to make a few quid out of this racket. Now we've shaken off those leeches over at something else. We've got a few, so there's a million things coming. And one of them is we are going to finally get round to appointing 50 saps. Official saps.
We had about five or six, didn't we?
We've got about five or six, but I'm actually going to write a certificate, sign it for the 50, laminate it, and they'll get it. Hang on, put the checkbook away. I'll tell you later how you could possibly become an actual official laminated sap. Oh my God, I'd forgotten the mania. Anyway, whenever you call the show, because the calls are all coming back and everything, you've got to say, by the way, laminated set number 38 here.
Mm-hmm.
He says, he, and if we're dealing with highbrow, he is a Quaker from Cambridge. He says, all that talk about dreams reminds me of two of my favourite books, one ancient, one modern. The ancient one first, from the Roman Empire, Archimedorus's Oneir Critica. He says, it's packed full of very helpful explanations of dreams that still have mileage today, like this one. Dream of a frying pan and it signifies loss. See, that's what I like, these sort of things. You think, yes.
Omen warnings.
How about this? How on earth even the Romans didn't laugh down their tunics at this one? Eating books signifies benefits for teachers, but for others portends a sudden death. Now, I've had some pretty wacky old dreams. I dreamt the other night my Nan Baker, my dad's mum, was inside one of the plastic boxes I keep LPs that are overspilled out in the shed. She was inside one of those driving it like a car. And my old man was sitting on a wall saying, take her home, hurry up, take her home. But eating books.
Old Artie Watsit didn't have that one down in his book.
Eating books. They did just one more from the ancient he gives us. If someone dreams of singing badly and off-key, this portends unemployment and poverty. now he's pulled these. He's literally pulling these out. He's pulling them out of his horse's rear end, isn't he? I might have mentioned once that the greatest anxiety dream. I think that's how we got onto this, Peps. Anxiety dreams. And I was. I'm sorry to bog us down in dreams here. I was. I dreamt once that I was handed a sitar by Paul McCartney, who said, "You're going to have to play this." And I said, I can't even play a drum, let alone a sitar. And all drummer sales, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
But I can't. And he said, no, we're doing the O2 tomorrow night.
Oh.
I had to learn the sitar for Paul McCartney at the O2, 24 hours. The sweat was coming off me like bullets. There's your anxiety dream. Anyway, Justin continues. The other book about dreams is Tim Etchell's The Dream Dictionary for the Modern Dreamer. Yeah, this is the ones you see in those shops with the crystals and that. I cannot recommend this enough because it includes entries that are completely neglected in most of the dream books. Justin the Quaker. He says, obsolete formats. To dream of an obsolete format from an 8-track cartridge to a Laserdisc, from Betamax to Hi8 to Super 8, suggests you need to change your thinking, unless your old habits and prejudices do you harm.
Oh, now this is good.
You think so?
Yeah. I mean, there's some common sense in that. If you're dreaming of a world of 8-tracks and Laserdiscs, you need to get with it, Grandpa.
But then he moves on to his second subject, everyone. He says, not Esperanto, because we did talk about Esperanto for a bit. Enjoyed the Esperanto last week. I did try to learn it years ago, but never got very far. However, I have become fluent in a much better language called Tokipona. This is less of an achievement than it sounds, as Tokipona only has 120 words, but you can, more or less, say anything in it and get fluent in 48 hours. Here, for example, is the phrase. This is a phrase Monty Python used in their famous translation sketch. My hovercraft is full of eels. So to say my hovercraft is full of eels in Tokipona, you say, Tomo tawa super mi pi lon, sewi la jo e kala linya mut mut. He says, and that really does say my hovercraft is full of eels. Tokipona is spoken by a few thousand people around the world. Those who speak it tend to be a chatty, harmless, though very vague bunch. Ali Lipona, that's everything's good. Mi tawa, bye-bye, Justin. And a beautiful...
Tokipona,
absolute,
right.
He's going to be at least in the top three laminated saps. Something over there, Peps. What you got?
This is Injured by a Hot Beverage. Gary from Grays. Back in the early 80s, my granddad was a steward at Arsenal's Highbury Stadium. In those days, security was extremely lax and it was very easy for him to sneak family and friends in. Teenage me attended virtually every home game. As he was a steward in the upper west stand, he was allocated two steward seats right on the end of the row adjacent to the entrance at the top of the bulkhead. So he would have the end seat, check tickets as supporters entered, and I would sit second along. One bitterly cold Saturday, we're in our seats and at half time, everyone left to get hot refreshments, tea, coffee, bovril. And as the second half started, many hadn't returned to their seats. Suddenly, Arsenal scored. My granddad jumped up to cheer and threw both arms in the air. As he did so, the man next to me was returning to his seat with his hot drink. Granddad's left arm connected with the cup, sent it high into the air, and the whole lot came straight down onto the head of the guy in front. Not only that, but the cup bounced off, leaving the tea bag and contents atop his head. The guy sat there for a few seconds before calmly plucking the tea bag from his head, mopping his head with a handkerchief, while we sat behind him, trying our best not to kill ourselves with laughter.
Wow.
He sat for the rest of the game with steam rising from his head and never once looked round.
Oh, how beautiful. What a lovely image. When I get the tea bag out of the tea cup here, and as you say, last Christmas, I bought the perfect gift for Wen. It's one of those great big tea trolleys they used to take around factories and offices in about 1960, because Wen, it mainlines the stuff. Makes a cup of tea. But fortunately, the actual bin, the bag needs to go in. And we've got a dispute here.
Oh, okay.
This was going to be a 10-minute show to say we're back. We've got a dispute here. Wen will put the used tea bag to one side to cool down before she puts it in the bin, because she's convinced it eats through, like
yes.
The alien's blood
yes.
And shrivels or sets fire.
Melts the bag.
It doesn't.
Yes.
It doesn't. Because
or
even
if you
though
put it in the food bin, it cooks all the rotten food. That's
no, it doesn't.
In the food bin.
It just goes in the bin, cools down like on that man's head. His head wasn't cooking, or well, it may have been. But anyway, so the bin's there, and we'll leave that to one side because I swear to God, no, I don't. I always let it cool down before I put it in there, but I don't, and nothing's ever happened. But it's about 3 feet away, and so it comes out, and I squeeze, as all civilized people do, I squeeze the bag out on the side of the cup before lifting it out to get the extra. And then, like an egg and spoon race, it sits on the spoon, and I have to lob it in one into the bin. It's only 3 feet away. Most times I get it, and that part of the kitchen is white behind it. So if I miss, I've got to rub down the walls.
Yeah.
But it's a tremendous indoor sport, and I'd like to hear people other tremendous indoor sports that, rather like Justin, got in touch. If you don't do it, something terrible is going to happen, and I certainly do that. Just before we go for an ad break,
mm-hmm.
I'll bring us this. This is from Andrew. I'll just read it, because all the subjects, obviously, are in the previous 52 shows, and you can go back through all of those, and all the subjects remain open. He says, the late 90s, it's the late 90s and a rainy morning in Dublin's Fair City. Now, Dublin's Fair City, of course, has to be described like that. And any time I hear Dublin, it spoils me, because you have to sing Alive, Alive. Oh, it's a beautiful song. No, it's a beautiful song in Dublin's Fair City, but it's no much ruin for me, Peps. Clockwork Orange. In Clockwork Orange, when they...
Oh, I've never been brave enough to watch Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange is fine. It looks a little bit camp these days. Malcolm McDowell, who's in A Clockwork Orange, big star, and If, of course, and Oh Lucky Man, of course, et cetera, is Malcolm McDowell. Malcolm McDowell, I didn't realise, not his star has fallen, but his latest film he's in, Malcolm McDowell, Hollywood's own Malcolm McDowell, late of these shores, right? Worked with Kubrick, and of course, and everybody else, and Lindsay Anderson. Malcolm McDowell's new film, he's billed under Vinnie Jones.
Oh.
He says he's quite happy with that, his work. Vinnie Jones's new film, which I don't know how hangdog that is, but billed underneath him is Malcolm McDowell. Clockwork Orange's own Malcolm McDowell.
Maybe Malcolm asked. Doesn't make a big deal out of it.
The love job, but apparently reading, an interview with him recently, he will take, many garage DVD departments are entirely fueled by vehicles that Malcolm has seen fit to not turn down. Anyway, Dublin's Fair City, where the girls are operating Molly Malone, ruined because in Clockwork Orange, they viciously beat up the tramp who's singing that.
Oh, no.
That might be another subject. Things that have been ruined for you by something. No. He's waving his hands. I'll tell you what, we'll do some adverts in this 10-minute show, and we'll be right back.
Good morning, everybody, it's the Danny Baker Show, radiating out across the airwaves. Come the sunshine or the rain, come aboard the Danny train, we'll kick our slippers off and throw our cares away. What better thing to do than have a jolly jape or two? Don't touch that dial, there's nowhere else to go. Come and join a happy session, wave ta-ta to the recession on the Danny Baker Show. Take it away, Danny.
And welcome back. And in that break, Peps and I, believe it or not, were talking about Bolivia.
We were.
It's actually the show.
Still trying to place it.
Right in the middle of the country, landlocked. And one thing I didn't tell you earlier on, I promise you, this is the last Bolivian thing I'll bring your way. Unless, but get in touch with us. We've got a new email address, which I can't remember what it is, but we'll get
in the treehousepod at gmail.com.
We're on Gmail now. Ooh, it's a new tin of paint. Okay, give it again. What is it?
inthetreehousepod@gmail.com.
Okay, maybe we should have done it the first half, because the old email address is full up with people responding to the first half of the show. But the last thing I'll tell you about Bolivia, you can stay, because they've got the biggest salt flat in the world over there. You can stay in an all-salt hotel built entirely from salt, and everything in the rooms is made of salt, including the furniture. How about that? If that isn't a reason to, even in these dodgy days, to get on a plane for 11 hours and pitch up, look at Peps thinking, is that a good thing?
I'm staring off into the desert. Yes, I'm trying to...
All salt. A salt hotel.
Be lovely for my hair, because my hair, I like beachy,
really?
salt water hair.
I'd like to think that several women listening to this are saying, what, the bed's made of salt and you lay on it all night? No, I don't...
Wilbur would love it, because he has just discovered at the age of four putting a bit of salt on his dinner. He thinks it's the most exciting thing ever.
I'm keeping a diary.
Child, he thinks this is highly exciting in his life.
I'm keeping a diary for the very first time in my life, and I couldn't tell you, I've written over 20,000 words of it in the last just over 3 weeks, and it's going to be part of the deal we're going to bring to it. And it's extraordinarily funny. I'd like to think it's as good as any of the books. And one of them is about my conversion to salt about a month ago. All my life, I've never, ever eaten salt. I won't give too much away because that's, I think, July the 8th century.
Never on your chips?
Never. And your reaction there is exactly why I didn't. And you're going to have to read it, but as an entire entry, including Michael Caine and I's discussion about salt. Yeah, I'm really selling this, ain't I? one of the levels, if you're good enough to sign up to, you'll get the daily diary and have a look at that salt entry. Whoa, boy. Look at your face. It freaks everyone out.
I mean, you must have tried salted chips and decided they weren't for you, or?
I'll give you this much, because otherwise, you know, we're just chucking away fivers here.
Yeah.
we'll be the judge of that. The only time I came across salt about the age of six, it was on crisps after they stopped giving you the option of the little twisted blue bag.
Yes.
I think they brought that back recently, but it used to be separate in your crisps. And I loved it. I enjoyed a packet of crisps. What can I tell you? Like television, there are only two channels. There was the plain and cheese and onion. That was it. When salt and vinegar came in, sensation. Joe Brown on the television advertising it. Come on. Anyway, and then my mate gave me a crisp with salt on it. I thought it tasted horrible. And I didn't touch salt.
If you get over salty crisps.
6 decades. But anyway, the Damascene revelation is all in the diaries. And the diaries, I must say, I've enjoyed writing more than anything. There's a scrapbook in there as well, pictures with the captions underneath. I'll outline it perhaps on a show that's shorter. But I was talking about Andrew, who began in his mail to us. The late 90s and a rainy morning in Dublin's fair city. Being at a loose end and being of a literary bent, I sought out the James Joyce Cultural Centre. And there's one in the eye for the salt flats. I sought out the James Joyce Cultural Centre and spent a thoroughly enjoyable and educational hour looking round the exhibits. Just going to pause it there again. I'm so sorry. James Joyce.
Ulysses? Never read it.
Of course,
it.
Ulysses. And that's all I know about it. And Ulysses, I literally can't make head or tail of. Not that I've read it, but I do follow on Twitter the daily James Joyce Ulysses tweet. And they put out a couple of sentences from it. I know it's disjointed, and I know someone like Paul Ross could sit me down now and say, you know, but it makes no sense. It's you know.
Repealed to me, truthfully.
No, and my one of my great top two heroes outside of P.G. Wodehouse, S.J. Perelman, it was his favourite book. So I have given it a go via chunks on Twitter, but I don't like Ulysses. by the bits I've seen on Twitter. So I would not have gone to the James Joyce Cultural Centre, but our friend Andrew did. He said, exiting, classically, through the gift shop, I picked up a book and went to give my money to the kindly elderly gentleman working there. We fell into conversation, and I expounded my fascinating theory on the Irish writer in exile. He nodded kindly in agreement and smiled away. Warming to my theme, I proceeded to give him a 5-minute lecture on James Joyce, even though he worked there, and all his writings. I told him about those, and having finished, I wished him well and went on my day. I thought nothing about this until 2 weeks later, when there was a travel program about Dublin on Channel 4, and they visited the James Joyce Centre, and they interviewed a man there, the very man I'd been talking to in the gift shop. It turned out he was Ken Moynihan, the last surviving nephew of James Joyce and the world's leading expert on the writer. He had never mentioned these facts and had sat there so patiently while I waffled on and on. He must have been waiting for the TV crew at the time. To this day, I'm still amazed that he learned so much from me in such a short time. Oh, bless you, Andrew. How about that? Think about Joyce. I find, and a lot of people won't agree with me, but I find, and the fella sitting there waiting for a camera crew, yep. The world's leading expert on it. Bless you. Thank you very much, Andrew. What you got there, Peps?
Mark in North Shields, this is Awful Holidays. Subtitle, How My Ex-Wife Got a Boat Decommissioned. On our holiday in Greece, my then wife and I enjoyed the first week of a fortnight on a small cruise ship taking us around the islands. However, it soon became apparent that several of our fellow passengers were a little odd. One garrulous lady of advanced years spent the evenings hectoring anyone she could collar about the dangers of fluoride in tap water. Another old girl claimed she could cure cats by the power of her mind. There was a Scottish academic who was three sheets to the wind by breakfast and spent all day propositioning any male female passengers. By the second week, we'd had enough and took to our non-air-conditioned cabin like the hot box in The Great Escape. We awoke one morning to see a rhinocerously drunk... Thank you, Mark.
Wow. Oh.
A rhinocerously drunk captain staggering back to the boat with a live octopus. Then things took a turn for the absolute worst.
Well, he doesn't elaborate on that. A man who's rhinocerously drunk with a live octopus heading back to the
boat. Nothing more.
One draws a veil over that.
One should draw a veil over the next part.
Oh, dear.
Because the boat had never got far enough shore to flush out the tanks...
Oh.
The contents visited us one morning through the shower plug hole.
Phil, I don't like to, intrude on the edit of this, but if you could just play the foghorn just now. Thank you. Carry on.
My ex-wife was a woman of few words, but back in Blighty, she penned a letter that got the boat decommissioned. Thank you, Mark.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, I'm sorry you had to hear portions of that, but it was good to hear the foghorn again after all this time. This is from Matt. I've caught up with a couple of more shows. Half 52 in our wake, yes. And I heard you talking about money boxes. Now, this is the first time coming across the show, apart from having to come up to speed with a rather manic way we all tumble onto the air. I want you to know that when we talk about money boxes, it's even better than the way we talk about Peru. And we did. We gave Amazon reviews of money boxes, of which there were many, and some were quite caustic. Anyway, he touches upon this. He says, I was given a postbox-shaped tin money box commemorating the Silver Jubilee in 1977. I started putting all the coins I had into it, all the ones that aunts had sent me, etc., for my birthday. When it came to getting it out, I discovered there was no opening in the thing. You had to just put a knife in the slot and shake it. But my mum said, just be careful. When it didn't work, she then went out for the day, and my dad took it off the top of it with a tin opener. He destroyed it, in fact. He just put a tin opener on it, and round it went, and it opened at the lid. Yes, a tin opener, destroying it in the process. And no money, obviously, could ever be placed in it again. Now, that's nice, you know, but people sometimes have to do that, as we discussed before. But it's what his last little paragraph he tacks on the end that really drew me to this, Matt. He said, by the way, my dad is the same man who later laid a new living room carpet by laying the new carpet on the lawn, placing the old carpet on top and cutting round it.
There's a part of me that goes, what's wrong with that?
Wendy said that. She went, well, it'll work. I said, yeah, but wherever you've got the furniture, it has to stay forever now. But he just put it on the lawn, put the old carpet on top of it and cut around it. Now, I've mentioned before that my dad was the worst, like I am, in what we might call traditional male skills. He is the man who didn't have a pasteboard when he wallpapered the front room. He used to turn the settee upside down and use that. But never did I think the old man would go out to the garden with a bit of carpet and cut around the old one. There would be shrinkage and frayage. One more, Peps, and I think we'll get out of these people's way. It's just good to be...
It's a lovely one to finish on. This is Charlie. Says, I'm broaching an unasked-for subject.
Good for you, yeah.
That's all part of the tradition, Charlie. Mm-hmm. But I seem to recall several years ago, you had the topic, have you lived inside a cartoon or similar?
Yes.
In the early 90s, as a new driver in my early 20s, I picked up my then-girlfriend Ruth in my glorious bright yellow second-hand Ford Escort, and off we set for some summer frolics on the open road. Ruth quickly explained before we went on the adventure she needed to pop to the local post office. Minutes later, there I was, sat behind the wheel, watching my girl head off, leaving me to enjoy the weather and music from my cassette player and watch the world go by. At this point, I noticed a small bedraggled dog beginning to saunter along the pavement and stopped outside the local butcher's. an old school establishment with many offerings displayed on the tables and racks outside the main window.
This isn't going where I think it's going, is it?
I watched with bated breath as the dog quietly and without fuss reached up and helped itself to, yes, the comic book staple, a string of sausages.
Nonsense, I can't.
Before turning tail and heading back in the direction he had come. And if that wasn't enough, seconds later, the butcher in an apron came charging out, shouting expletives in the dog's general direction. He reappeared moments later, sausageless, shaking his head. I had a timeless moment placing me directly into the beano. And every time I think of it, my soul smiles.
I dare say in his, I'll use the word fanciful, in his fanciful description there, the butcher was even wearing a straw hat. I'll guarantee that. That did come from a subject ages ago, but have you ever seen anything that really happened in a cartoon? That was the subject. Because I did ask, has anyone ever sat in a doctor's waiting room? And there is a mother, and next to her, a little boy has got a saucepan stuck on his head. Because that, again, I don't think outside of a cartoon has ever existed. Anyway, all our correspondents and everyone who can hear us now, thank you very much for sticking with us during the break. We are back, and details of what we are planning, and I hope you can go with us on that, will be coming forward in the stanza. The shows, certainly the Tuesday show, remains free as the air you breathe, but to get the additional ones, we're just going to ask to join us on Patreon to keep this racket going. But it ain't just going to be that. I have been in the process of putting 40 odd years of what I do, from the tours to the books to this record room to reviews to the diary to various essays, even getting in touch with the cast of Cried at the Grave, and we're going to do audio commentary on all the episodes and things like that. So it's entirely up to you what level you want to join us in. But you can hear, we enjoy doing these shows more than you'd know. And when you see some of these rackets of people have got going out, there are no names here, I'll tell them off the air. You know, send us some money and you get our very best wishes, or 5 minutes extra to show, or you get it 10 minutes before everyone else. No, it's not going to be that. I wouldn't mooch you like that. But we did feel that we could try and do this, to bring it all under our own roof and, you know, sisters doing it for themselves. So we'll see how that goes, hopefully, with your backing. In the meantime, here comes the theme tune.
1, 2, 3, 4. Treehouse. Climb up, go in, let's cozy down. Wave goodbye to that silly frown as we chase our cares away.
In the treehouse,
the fire's on, it's warm inside. We guarantee you'll be satisfied as we laugh the day away.
In the treehouse.
Take it away, Danny! Thank you very much indeed to Louise Pepper on the other side of the table, to me anyway, figuratively. Phil Wilding, who still sits there shaking his head saying, I've got to edit all this up in a minute. But as always, it's chiefly yourselves. We're back, everyone.